This week on Your Western Context, a public inquiry finally digs into the Nova Scotia shooting. Oregon condemns those with non-BC license plates, and Trudeau's health minister doesn't take her own advice. Also, the Governor General is investigated for workplace harassment. This is Western Context, episode 180, recorded Saturday, August 1st, 2020. Misplaced Anger. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here, as we are each and every week. And, you know, this week's a bit of a quieter week than we've seen in the past few, but nonetheless, there's still some news that managed to creep in that the media wasn't all too honest about this week.
Yeah, that's true. There was a lot of stories that came about this week. A lot that has been brewing over the last couple months, of course, and a lot that the media has just now been investigating and trying to reveal what's been going on. And some of these stories we've actually talked about in the past before, even going back many years, and they're just receiving the light of coverage now, and there seems to be a lot of surprise about them when in reality, the signs were there all along if you knew what to look for.
Indeed, and if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast where we aim to cut through all that media bias and sensationalism, and hopefully in doing so we'll provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin with one of our Canada stories this week, and this one's a follow-up from a story that happened back in April, of course, but since we were mid-pandemic, the middle of the first wave, as it was back then, media really didn't do their due diligence on the story back in April, and now we're actually seeing the truth come to light, as we predicted it would be here on the podcast when we first talked about it. And what we're talking about, of course, is the horrible Nova Scotia shooting that happened back on in April that took the lives of 22 people. And as we do here at Western Context, we believe that you can only make proper decisions, of course, you are listeners, when you have all the context on a given news story. And the media, and when it comes to this story, and in particular when it comes to gun control, waits a very short amount of time before framing the issue of gun control as one as it is exactly in the United States. But as we've said many times before on the podcast, we share a border with the U.S., but we do not share their politics or problems wholesale. Now, as the original story developed, it became known that the guns used at the rampage were actually smuggled into the country from Maine, the state right below Nova Scotia. Now, what we didn't know, however, and it was revealed this week, that the RCMP was actually aware of the shooter and was aware that he had been smuggling guns in the years past. This led Public Safety Minister Bill Blair this week, who also happens to be the former Toronto City Police Chief, to set up a public inquiry on the shooting. Blair said that Canadians deserve answers to know how such a tragedy could occur, and, you know, here at Western Context, that's obvious. That's honestly the first grade question to ask. But of course, what we need to get to is to the bottom of this and just why exactly this shooter, this criminal, got past the RCMP and why nothing was done to stop his smuggling in of weapons from Maine. The inquiry was also announced just a day before the Prime Minister was due to testify at the Ethics Committee, so yet again, this was a perfect opportunity for a channel change as seen by the Liberal government and the Prime Minister, which of course is something that he loves turning the channel to, gun control. We'll see this though, that the deck had already been set when it comes to the shooting. The inquiry was called after documents released to the Canadian press revealed a picture that showed that the gunman's activities before they began would have definitely raised some eyebrows. The neighbors around him were aware of concealed spaces on his property for years, and there was even a secret room at his dentist clinic and a false wall on his property. It's also been said that pushbacks from the families and MPs are what led to the reversal on whether or not the government would call the public inquiry. Bill Blair said also this week that he was unaware of the additions to the case, as we previously mentioned here in the story. Now, the new information that was presented this week on this case, and quite honestly, is disgusting and is stomach-churning. So we've made the decision to spare the graphic details of what exactly was found on the property here from the audio record at Western Context. Ultimately, this new information revealed this week, revealed Wortmann as a sick and twisted criminal with a heinous backstory that rivals the plot of TV shows such as Breaking Bad or Dexter. The RCMP was aware of the gun smuggling and drug problem behind the shooter, but nothing ultimately happened with that. Now, we have Bill Blair and the government of Canada. They see an opportunity to get to the bottom of what actually happened in Nova Scotia with this public inquiry, which, of course, raises lots of questions that the media should have been asking a couple of months ago. But, of course, the story wouldn't be complete without mentioning the hypocrisy of the government and the media in their initial coverage that led them to not ask these questions. This wasn't an event in Canada that led the government to issue the largest blanket gun ban that we've seen in Canadian history. And they didn't do this with parliamentary oversight with a bill and new legislations, but instead by an order in council, which of course means the Ministry of Justice picked up the pen and wrote that certain types of firearms would effectively be blacklisted and become illegal in Canada. And this has the benefit or drawback, depending on how you look at this, as a future government can come in and simply undo this since it was done through an order in council and not a new law. Now, flipping back to this gun ban, it included common firearms that are used by farmers to protect livestock, but it also included absurdities such as the Mark 153 SMAW rocket launcher, the FGM-148 Javelin missile launcher, and the Russian artillery M-1942 anti-tank gun, just to name a few things that were included in this blanket ban. For the media's part on this story, the one of gun control in Canada, and that we would be so much better off with the government taking action on gun control to protect our big cities because they have gun violence problems that, you know, if you believe the media, rival what we see in the United States. In doing so, they often cited exactly what happens in the United States. You look to big cities like Chicago and New York when it comes to violence, but here, instead, today, we see that both the media and the government missed the boat. What should have been a story about the RCMP policing, strengthening our border control, and ultimately handling the opioid epidemic back in April became an opportunity for the Trudeau government and the media to virtue signal on the issue of gun control. Now we see the truth coming out only because documents were leaked to the media, and of course it was a convenient time for the government to announce it as it was right before the Prime Minister was due to testify. We don't like to sound too arrogant here at Western Context, but yet again, it looks like we were right in the initial summation of the story and the media misled Canadians yet again.
Yes, exactly. The whole issue surrounding gun control coming out from the mass shooting here was a story of misdirection, and the government was trying to mislead Canadians as to what exactly the issue surrounding the mass shooting was. And I think that a lot of people could see the gun control ban as opportunistic at best by the Liberal government. And given the fact that most of the gun shooting deaths that occur in Canada are generally from illegal guns that are crossing over the border and smuggled in from the United States and are happening in our biggest cities, mostly in Toronto. This gun ban didn't do anything to address any of that. It didn't address anything regarding border security. It didn't address anything surrounding gangs. It didn't address anything surrounding actual gun violence and the lax sentencing that people that are actually caught and found guilty of gun crimes actually don't get very much in the way of a jail sentence. And those were the big issues surrounding gun violence in Canada, and a government that actually took steps to address those would probably be lauded by both sides of the aisle. But given the fact that they were just doing this to virtue signal that they could ban whatever guns they wanted and that they could look like they were doing something when in fact they weren't, it really was quite disgusting response to the mass shooting.
And when it comes down to it, it's all a matter, of course, in the media's eyes of making whatever's going on in Canada look similar to the United States and then show that we're progressing with a solution, even though it's not exactly the same problem. And I don't think many people in the media realize this, but most of the gun violence that we see in Canada is indeed imported across the border through illegal firearms. And these are handguns that we're talking about. They're not the large weapons that were used in the Nova Scotia shooting or the weapons that were banned in the gun ban. And when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, it was a matter of opportunity by the government at hand to do that. And, you know, we're going to see exactly what happened in this Nova Scotia shooting where 22 people lost their lives. And we're going to see exactly what the RCMP can do different, hopefully, to prevent this going forward in the future. Because a lot of our population, a lot of our country borders the United States. And when it comes down to smuggling and border security, that's something that we have been very critical of since beginning this podcast. And it's something that the government, the Liberal government in Ottawa, seems to be completely away from the wheel on. And nobody seems to be wanting to ask this question. So this is definitely something that we're going to watch as it materializes over the next year or so, the public inquiry on this matter. But we're going to move from the East Coast to the West Coast right now. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment to talk about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext, where you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to. We offer three tiers of support for the price of a cup of coffee. You can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that, and you can have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production show notes throughout the entire week. And in case you're wondering what we're going to be doing with this, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll craft two Patreon-exclusive articles expanding on our show stories from the month. And these articles will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast. Every other month, we'll reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. All right, what do we got for BC?
So, in BC, we've got a little bit of a doozy here. We've got the Premier, John Horgan, actually having a bit of a misstep. And in the 3 and a bit years since John Horgan became BC Premier, he's run a fairly tight ship. And he's convinced many that his minority government, propped up by the Greens, deserves a fair shake. And polls taken since the beginning of the pandemic have shown Horgan's government to score very highly among governments in Canada for their work through the health crisis. The government's handling of the pandemic received sky-high approval levels from those polled, with 85% thinking the government has done a good job of combating the virus so far. Now, the safety net of careful surplus spending throughout the previous 3 years by Horgan and his finance minister, Carol James, also means that BC is in a much better position financially than most, if not all, other provinces. And BC still maintains a triple A credit rating from all major institutions. And all this has led to a high mark personal approval rating of Horgan at 68%, while his NDP are polling around 45% to the BC Liberals' 33%. But Horgan's leadership has not been without his faults, however. While in opposition, he had the reputation of being brash, loud, and hot-headed. And since becoming premier, he has toned down his passionate character somewhat, but sometimes it still peeks through. Enter last week the issue of vehicles with out-of-province license plates, not just American plates, but Alberta and other provinces as well, are continuing to be vandalized, and it's become a serious issue in BC. Now, we covered the story back at the end of May on Western Context 171, where numerous BC residents with vehicles that had out-of-province plates on them found their cars keyed, windows smashed, or even just nasty notes being put on them. Now, Premier Horgan made a statement on the issue, which actually contradicted Chief Medical Officer Dr. Bonnie Henry's calm and measured approach on the matter. Horgan says that drivers who have out-of-province license plates on their vehicles should consider taking public transit or riding a bicycle if they're feeling harassed by people. He also suggested on Monday that drivers change to BC plates to avoid trouble from residents who are concerned about the spread of COVID-19, saying that he, quote, can't tell people how to respond when they see an offshore plate. Now, a follow-up question from the media asked Horgan, was the premier really suggesting that they should take transit or change their vehicle registration or just prepare to be harassed? Horgan replied defensively, quote, what else would you have me say? People are being judgy and I'm urging them to not be judgy. It's best that we not blame people for the license plates on their car, but having said that, if you're living in BC and plan on staying in BC, the appropriate thing to do would be to get a BC driver's license and a BC plate on your vehicle. If you feel that traveling with your plates, identifying yourself as someone from away at a time of heightened anxiety, it's incumbent on those individuals to take steps to reduce that anxiety. I don't know what's wrong with that response. It doesn't seem jaw-dropping to me. So while that innocuous statement, what he thinks is a very innocuous statement, has actually proven to be fairly controversial, because instead of condemning those committing property vandalism crimes, he instead told the victims how they should respond. He said, quote, in BC, we want to keep our borders closed until neighboring jurisdictions get a better handle on COVID-19. Those who are overtly declaring their license plates that they've come from somewhere else should be mindful of that and act accordingly. Now, keeping in mind through all this that ICBC, the provincial crown corporation that deals with vehicular insurance, just recently opened up parts of their services after being in a semi-lockdown for the past 5 months, and many ICBC outlets have actually gotten swamped with requests and work, and just going in and changing your license plate, as Horgan suggests, is not actually that easy to do with ICBC's current state. For example, the Victoria branch of ICBC has seen road tests being pushed back to October because of the high volume of requests. Now, even if you do change the ICBC insurance to a provincial insurance in BC, it doesn't change the fact that British Columbians through ICBC pay the highest insurance rates in Canada. So in that regard, it's no wonder that those who prefer to license their cars elsewhere actually do so. But it really just comes down to one simple principle. If elected leaders refuse to even condemn illegal acts, aren't they signaling in a nudge-nudge, wink-wink sort of way that they're actually okay with the behavior? Through what he's saying, Horgan is as much as saying that if you see a non-BC vehicle, do what you want. Now, Dr. Bonnie Henrys carefully measured her statement when she was asked about the premier's remarks. She said, quote, there are many reasons why people have different license plates here in BC. Many Canadians and British Columbians returned from living in the U.S. where they've been there for a short time or a long period of time. Who would blame them considering what's happening now? Many people come home to look after elderly family members, and we need to respect that. We also need to respect that many people have been here for a long time. They may have already done their isolation. We don't know everyone's story. We need to pay attention to the fact that we're all in this together, whether our license plate is from Alberta, California, or from here. We are here now, and we all need to do things that keep us, keep each other safe here and now. Now, even the RCMP has cautioned people to think before they act. Campbell River RCMP Constable Maury Tyre says that there are many snowbirds who live on Vancouver Island and split their time between places down south like Palm Springs, Scottsdale, Arizona, and Tampa Bay, Florida. He said, quote, when COVID-19 struck hard back in March, many of these people found themselves stranded in the United States, with the only way to return being in their car that were registered in those states. Add to that the extra difficulty of insuring your BC vehicle with insurance offices closed, and these folks have continued to drive their American insured vehicles. Tyre is now sending out a message to all islanders, be calm and be kind. He says, quote, "We are seeing actions being taken by some that can border on criminal harassment just because somebody has an out-of-country or out-of-province license plate or a little bit of an accent." He says, quote, "I recognize that people are on edge, scared or frustrated, but harassing actions and stirring up a frenzy are just not acceptable and are entirely contrary to the well-being of a civil society." Oak Bay Police here in Victoria had fielded many reports from locals that people are driving around with American plates and actually had to go on a social media campaign to get people to stop calling them in and to say that having a U.S. license plate in itself is not a crime. Deputy Chief Ray Bernardi said that, quote, "We will investigate any allegations of someone breaching quarantine. However, we have no intention of stopping every vehicle that has a U.S. plate. Some people have completed their quarantine and are driving legally with their U.S. plates, and they should not be repeatedly stopped and interrogated by police simply due to their plates." So at a time where pandemic fears are heightened and the media has scared the populace into a panic, it's up to our leaders to provide a calm and measured approach. For BC, our premier might need a few more lessons on how to do just that. And for the criminals breaking the law by vandalizing non-BC cars and the busybodies harassing people just because they might be from elsewhere, it's disgustingly xenophobic, and as the police have said, can become criminal very quickly. As always, we should be calm, be kind, take personal precautions, but don't jump to conclusions about everything you see, because after all, the media never gives the full story.
And that's precisely why Western Context is here in existence. And, you know, we had, of course, the similar story when it came to keying in the past. And, you know, you imagine you look at different jurisdictions. If it was, for example, Doug Ford or Jason Kenney saying something like that, you would have totally imagined that they would get lit up in the media by that. And in BC, there is obviously more of a border community than there is in Alberta, just because of the geography and the way the population is laid out. And this is a very unique problem, and I'd imagine you also see it in Ontario and in Quebec as well. But the point at the end of the day is that it's not so much about where the person is from, it's that if are they actually following the rules for when they arrived in Canada. And, you know, these lockdowns started a long, long time ago, and as it stands right now, the only people who can move through the Canada-US border are people who are deemed essential, those who are carrying trade, and those who are going to see close family members. And aside from that, there's really nothing moving across the US border. And looking back to when the US border was first shut down in Canada, that was a long time ago. So there's a very good chance that most of the Washington State plates, the Oregon plates, the California plates that you'd be seeing in Canada at this point have been here legally and are just residing in the country. And this is something I think many Canadians aren't aware of. There's actually a lot of cross-border residents who have a house in, for example, Washington State, or have a house in BC, and they move freely between them. That's not an anomaly, and that's one of the benefits of our close relationship with the United States. And as the pandemic winds down, many people are going to be very eager to get back to that cross-border movement.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there is more cross-border movement in Canada and the United States than there is in many other places in the world. And there's a lot of Americans that live in Canada. There's a lot of Canadians that live in America. There's a lot of Canadians that live in America that also live in Canada, too. There's dual citizens that go back and forth. So people making judgment calls and being busybodies with reporting to police just because they see someone driving by with a different license plate, it's frankly a waste of everyone's time at this point. And the fact that people are doing so just goes to show there's nothing else for them to do at the moment. And the media has scared people so much into believing that anybody from outside, even from the next city over, that is in your town, is capable of spreading a disease. Well, at this point, everybody is. But the thing is that transmission rates are so low that you shouldn't be in a panic. You shouldn't be paranoid. You should be careful about what's going on, but you shouldn't get into a frothing panic about this and worry your mental health even more than it already has been in the last few months. And I think that a lot of people just need to stay calm and relax and just go about their own business and take care of themselves. And the media trying to encourage this panic continuing through the next few months, it just is detrimental to everybody.
Indeed, indeed. And in order to ensure that the public does not panic, we need to have sound advice from our public health officials. And, you know, we've had many great examples in BC with Dr. Bonnie Henry, in Alberta with Dr. Hinshaw, all being figures that people look up to, and their respective health ministers, of course. But as we've talked about time and time again, the federal response on the pandemic has been wishy-washy, whether it be about the initial discussion of banning flights coming in from affected areas such as China and Italy and the like. But we're not talking about that, because we need to talk about the public health minister this week, the health minister nationally, Patty Hajdu. And since the beginning of March, we've been accustomed to these public health officials and the health ministers telling people to stay home, to not travel if they don't need to. We've seen travel bans put in place on what would normally be some of the busiest travel weekends of the spring and summer, such as Easter and Victoria Day. Governments ultimately earn the respect of their voters. It's not something that's granted by fiat. We learned that the hard way in the many dictatorships that rose up over the 20th century, and as such, there's a natural distrust of government, and that's a healthy thing, and that's why governments need to earn the respect of their voters. And this is part of the reason why jurisdictions that have seen some of the best results in stamping down the virus, such as Alberta and BC, were able to do so without highly restrictive lockdown orders. Now, granted, it's not just staying at home. It's only part of the solution as to why it worked. It was, though, recently revealed that Federal Health Minister Patty Hajdu traveled on both of these weekends between Ottawa and Thunder Bay, where she lives. She was aboard, the only person actually aboard, a seven-seater Cessna Citation that costs about $1,400 per hour to operate. And with the flights that she took and the amount of flying that she did, this puts the bill for the flights that the minister was on at about $73,000. $73,220, to be precise, according to Blacklock's reporter. Now, the weekends in which she traveled were Easter weekend and the Victoria Day long weekend, where travel bans were in place. This is, of course, the same weekend where the Prime Minister made the plea for people to not travel by himself, saying that he was staying home and not seeing his family while they were at Harrington Lake. But, of course, at the same time, one of his most senior ministers, the health minister, who was very important during this pandemic, was traveling and flying between Ottawa and Thunder Bay. Now, when we look at this, as recently as this past Friday, the health minister was still heavily cautioning Canadians to not travel as a way to reduce the risk of COVID-19, which is, of course, fine. You reduce the movement of the population, you reduce the chance for the virus to spread. But this is, of course, the same pattern in the media and the opposition liberals that back in 2010 criticized former finance minister Jim Flaherty when he flew back to his home riding on a similar jet. And this is a stunning level of hypocrisy for the government, of course, to say that, you know, you shouldn't be traveling around, you shouldn't fly, you should stay home. But instead, the health minister is going to fly. And this very much perforates the idea of one rule for the ruling class and one rule for everyone else. And this greatly, greatly reduces the amount of public trust that the government has. And we saw similar situations like this crop up here in Alberta in the past, where we had similar costs, where there were huge, extravagant costs seen by then Premier Alison Redford. This caused the new incoming Premier Jim Prentice to sell the government fleet. Now, granted, the federal government can't do that entirely, since it's not 100% viable to have the Prime Minister or head of state fly commercial, but certainly ministers can fly commercial. And it's long time since that the rules over private government flights at the federal level be tightened up. The government in this case needs to lead by example and practice what they preach, or they will lose the will of Canadians to follow their advice at this crucial time during the pandemic. And we know if a population loses trust of their government, they're more likely to throw them out, and the debate in that country only becomes more polarized. So this is a very important learning lesson for both the Canadian media and the health minister, Patty Hajdu.
Yes, exactly. And it's another example of the Trudeau government practicing the do as I say, not what I do. And it was four trips, but only two of them were actually involved in constituency business. And neither of those were in-person appearances. They could have been done over the phone, because one was a Zoom conference with the Thunder Bay Chamber of Commerce, and another one was a phone call to a local radio station to share her gratitude for essential workers. And her staff identified the purpose of travel as various departmental briefings and meetings, but in the end, any of it could have been done while she was in Ottawa in the first place. And this is coming after press conferences where she's going out and saying, do not go visit your family, do not visit your friends, do not go out and about unless it's essential. And then she hops on a plane herself, bills taxpayers thousands of dollars, and goes back to her own family and friends in her Thunder Bay riding. And it just goes to show that, as you said, there is one set of rules for the ruling class, one set of rules for everyone else. And time again, we've seen the Trudeau government deal with this. And for the health minister herself, who is the point woman for the pandemic, you would think that she would realize the optics of what she's doing.
Yeah, and time again, it, you know, proves what better situation we would have been in nationally had we had a doctor as a health minister. And we had an opportunity for that, but she was run out of cabinet.
Yeah, exactly. And to be able to have a better position in cabinet, it goes all the way back to 2015 when Trudeau first took power, and cabinet decisions there were put in place for the optics, not for the actual experience. And I think this is just a summation of something that's just gone on during the Trudeau government.
And it continues on, and it's rampant throughout appointments in the federal government. And it even happened at the top with the appointment of our governor general. And that's what we're talking about in our firing line this week.
Yes, our firing line segment is a story that talks about a story that isn't very much covered in the media, is either covered in the completely wrong way in the media, or it just does not receive the attention it deserves. And I think this is a story that really didn't receive much attention. It was there was rumors and rumblings going back to 2018, and we can actually say, can't we say we told you so, because we covered the story all the way back on Western Context 86 back in September of 2018, that foreshadowed the upcoming story with the Governor General. And that story detailed the failure to launch a former astronaut Julie Payette's turbulent first year as Governor General. And that story talked about Governor General Julie Payette and her struggles with a job that required public appearances, strict adherence to convention, and lots of public scrutiny. In it, the article describes the duties of the Governor General and how one of the most important duties is to sign bills into law, and how on several occasions Payette didn't actually appreciate having to work her schedule around Parliament, and actually asked if it was really necessary that she be at ceremonies signing budgets and big bills into law. Now, sources say that in 2018, that during Julie Payette's first year as Governor General, she had been locked in a year-long battle with the expectations and restraints that come with being Governor General, demands on her personal time, expectations of how she should dress, what she can say in public, and how she should work with politicians, diplomats, and bureaucrats. Many members of the tight-knit community that operates in and around Rideau Hall said that they have grown frustrated with the Governor General, who constantly challenges tradition and had substantially reduced the workload of her office. However, most believe the blame lies with the Prime Minister's office for abandoning the advice of vice-regal experts and choosing a star candidate without ensuring that she would be a good fit for the job. Now, people who had observed firsthand previous transitions at Rideau Hall said that this goes beyond the typical growing pains. One senior government source said that, quote, "It's not unusual for a governor general to test the limits, but there's clearly more than testing going on here. It's a delicate situation." At that time, Rideau Hall's participation in public events had dwindled. Its relationships with nonprofit organizations, even those going back decades, had remained under review. Event organizers accustomed to the Governor General's participation have been cautioned not to take it for granted. One source with extensive knowledge of the institution said, quote, "There's no question the pace in the activity is the slowest it's been since the 70s or 80s. Now, Julie Payette's name did not come up until late in the ad hoc process that the Trudeau administration set up to find Governor General David Johnson's replacement. In 2012, Trudeau's predecessor, Stephen Harper, created the Advisory Committee on Vice-Regal Appointments, which is a panel of experts to help the government select future governor generals, provincial lieutenant governors, and territorial commissioners. Now, since Trudeau came to power in October 2015, his government has not consulted the committee for any such appointment. Now, let's fast forward to today and Trudeau's failures to vet one of the most important roles in Canadian democracy has come back to rear its head. The Privy Council Office has launched what it says will be a thorough, independent, and impartial workplace probe into claims of harassment and verbal abuse in the office of Governor General Julie Payette. The investigation follows a report that quoted unnamed sources saying that Payette has created a toxic work environment at Rideau Hall by verbally harassing employees to the point where some have been reduced to tears or have left the office altogether. At least 16 sources, 16 of them, with direct knowledge of the office during Payette's mandate, said that the Governor General had yelled at, belittled, and publicly humiliated employees. They accused her of throwing tantrums in the office, and on one occasion, tossing an employee's work aside and calling it shit. That's quoted from the article. Even quizzing them on their knowledge of the solar system. They also accused Payette's secretary and longtime friend, Assunta DiLorenzo, of harassing employees, calling some lazy and incompetent. Now, the Privy Council Office, or PCO, spokesperson Stefan Schenk said that in the statement that, quote, "Harassment has no place in any professional workplace. It is a public service priority to advance efforts to more effectively prevent and resolve issues of harassment." The PCO statement said that the Governor General's office is part of the core public service and is subject to Treasury Board policies, which include a policy against harassment. PCO said that the office is establishing the terms of reference of the review and will take steps immediately to hire an independent third party to conduct it. Now, one former employee is speaking out against what they described as a toxic work environment at the office of Payette. The source says, quote, "Right from the beginning, I was appalled at what was going on. At first, I was like, okay, I have to give myself time to figure this out, or maybe things are really busy right now and they're tense. I don't know. But the atmosphere, the vibe, the stress, the constant barrage, it was just unbearable." A 2009 government survey backs up the claims from the sources at Rideau Hall, which said that the office has the third highest harassment levels in the federal public service. 22% of respondents working for Rideau Hall claimed to have experienced harassment, and 74% of them attributed it to individuals with authority over them. The Privy Council Office says that it's aware of the survey, but hadn't received any formal complaints in writing. Sources say that they have complained informally to the Ombudsman and to Human Resources, but claim that sufficient action wasn't taken. But based on accounts given to the National Post, the people who may have been least shocked about the Rideau Hall workplace turmoil were people who worked under Payette between 2013 and 2016, when she ran the Montreal Science Center as chief operating officer. For those who chose to speak for that story, they said that their motivation was not to grind an axe years after the fact, but to point out that the Prime Minister's office shouldn't have been taken by surprise that many Rideau Hall employees are having a very difficult time working for Payette, because it's all happened before. The accounts given by the people working for the Montreal Science Center give a nuanced picture of how Payette manages a workplace. She forms close bonds with people who she trusts and pushes them constructively, but others say that Payette would sometimes pick fights and level harsh criticism at them, but they could still brush it off and still having a good working relationship. But for some people, working for Payette was excruciating. Just as in the story about Rideau Hall, some Science Center employees said that they left conversations with Payette in tears and frequently felt humiliated in meetings where Payette targeted them. One person who had worked for the Science Center for many years but quit directly because of Payette said, quote, "I'm going to say that when I read the news, nothing at all surprised me." Another said, quote, "Everything sounded extremely familiar. There was a line in the story saying that there was always a victim in every meeting. It was the same thing at the Science Center." Now, when Payette entered the job of running the Montreal Science Center in the summer of 2013, there was widespread concern at the center about this move at the time, because when Payette was hired, she had no experience in running a museum. But as an astronaut with a sparkling resume in science, music, and the languages, she had celebrity status in Quebec, and it was hoped that her appointment would bring in large donations and sponsorship. In the end, though, it led to staff leaving and a high amount of stress among the remaining staff. Now, the failures of Payette's leadership and management style were there to be seen, but the attraction to Trudeau of having a female astronaut in the position was worth more than doing his due diligence and actually vetting candidates properly for the position. And now, one of the most important positions in democracy in Canada is being degraded, all due to the Prime Minister, who couldn't do his job properly in the first place.
And there's an important distinction to be made here with this. Normally, at Western Context, when it comes to talking about stories that are based entirely on anonymous sources, we prefer to take a step back and wait to see if they develop. Because we've seen over the past years since we started this that anytime a story mentions an anonymous source, it is often token discussion for fake news. But we did extra due diligence with this story. We made sure that what we were reading in here was actually the case. And it's a very, very important story to be talking about. One, because it has everybody backing up the facts of how she ran the Science Center, for example, or how many people feel around the Governor General's office. But we also need to remember that this story is so important because we are currently in the state of a minority government. So if the Trudeau government, actually when the Trudeau government faces a confidence vote and loses, because pretty much all minority governments will face a confidence vote and lose, when they face that vote, it will be up to the Governor General to determine if the government either has a new election or if somebody else in the House of Commons tries to take over and form a government. And the same thing can be said if there's another minority government after that. The Governor General, at this point in time, is one of the most important pieces of our constitutional democracy here in Canada. And that is why this is one of our stories this week, because it is just so important for all Canadians to understand what exactly is going on with this. And when you compare Julie Payette to David Johnston, David Johnston was a constitutional expert. And that's precisely the reason Stephen Harper chose him as Governor General and asked him to stay on, is because in choosing him, he chose somebody who would have that constitutional background in the minority government that he was in at the time he was appointed. He won a majority after the fact, but the point still remains that David Johnston was chosen because of his constitutional background.
Yeah, exactly. And the position of the Governor General needs to be above reproach because it holds such an important role in our democracy and whether a government can continue to exist and whether bills and other items can be actually signed into law. And not only that, but a Governor General is also one of Canada's most important figures and therefore needs to be a good diplomat and be able to meet with a lot of different people on any given basis. And there's a lot of work that goes into it. And it seems that throughout Julie Payette's role as Governor General, she's been trying to reduce the workload of the job and try and reduce her public appearances and try to change ages-old convention that's been happening for hundreds of years with the Governor General. And as you can see, with Trudeau flying in the face of all the vice-regal experts and all of the constitutional experts, and appointing someone that wasn't prepared for the job and who actually had a history of mismanagement and not being able to work well with the staff, the answers were there. But for some reason, Trudeau and the Prime Minister's office didn't want to look at that and didn't want to take that into consideration. And once again, it's just another example of Trudeau's leadership and his appointments.
Yeah, and ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact that the Governor General is the Queen's representative, Queen Elizabeth's representative in Canada. And another lens you can put on this is, what kind of person, in theory, would you like to be having the meeting with Queen Elizabeth at the end of the day? And if it's somebody who operates with class, knows what they're doing, then that's fine. But on the other hand, do you really want somebody in that position who is belittling to employees? I don't think that Queen Elizabeth would be very proud of that. So we'll have to wait and see what comes from this inquiry. But I think that can take us nicely into our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is public inquiry, which is defined as an official review of an event that has deeply affected the public. This could be anything from a mass murder to a tragic accident or infrastructure failure. And this is the inquiry is ordered by the government. Now, it accepts evidence and conducts its hearings in a more public forum, where advocacy groups can present their findings as well. So this is why people were wanting a public inquiry with the Nova Scotia mass shooting, because the evidence and findings would be made public and their report would be then released to the public, and nothing would be either covered up or hush-hushed by the government. And as you can see with the government's response to the mass shooting with their gun ban, nothing we can see from the government is going to be impartial on this matter because of how they conducted themselves in the aftermath of the argument. And I think this is why a lot of people were looking for a public inquiry and why it's taken the government an excess of 3 months to actually announce one to be taking place, and the fact that the timing of the announcement coincided right before Trudeau was about to testify in front of the Finance Committee on the We Charity scandal just goes to show that this the government is not really looking for this public inquiry to actually do good work. They were just wanting it as a distraction.
Indeed. And it's going to be very important to see what the conclusions are and how it informs the RCMP. And we're also going to, you know, have to have an inquiry. I don't know if it'll be a public inquiry, an investigation at least on the Governor General's stance on this. So all in all, public inquiry is a good word of the week to wrap up this edition of Western Context. And with that, if you want full show notes, if you want to look at all our supplementary sources for this episode, you can find that and more at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast and any number of podcast listeners out there at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where you can find the show and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all of the stories that the media talks about and a lot that they aren't talking about, just so we can get to the full story and to find out every possible angle that a story talks about, whether it's in print, radio, news, on the TV, online. We will find it and we'll make sure that you have the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.